From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with George Cadwallader. For the past 15 years, he's operated an island school for delinquent boys. He thought the Spartan lifestyle would give the boys a clean start, but he's discovered the answer to the problem of juvenile delinquency isn't that simple. Also today, jazz singer and songwriter David Frischberg is back at the piano for part two of our interview. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from Norwegian pianist and composer Per Husby. Kevin says it's time American listeners caught on to Husby's music. And television critic David Bianculli figures out when and why moonlighting stopped being the hippest show on TV. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. On the island of Penikese, off the coast of Cape Cod, George Cadwallader runs an experimental reform school for delinquent teenage boys. Cadwallader first saw the island as a place where troubled kids can make a physical and symbolic break with their past, which led to crimes as serious as rape and murder. Life isn't easy on the island. The boys learn how to rough it. They cut wood to keep warm and grow vegetables to eat. Since 1973, the Massachusetts Department of Youth Services has referred boys to the Penikese Island School. The average stay is 6 months. But don't count on miracles from this island reform school. In his new book, Castaways, Cadwallader writes, "This is the story of an experiment that would appear to have failed, because the overwhelming majority of the boys returned to crime." He describes his book as the story of a school and the fall from innocence of those who started it. But despite his disillusionment, Cadwallader, an ex-Marine, has not given up. I spoke with George Cadwallader from WGBH in Boston. I asked him to elaborate on something he says in his book. He writes, "Visitors arrive at Penikese expecting to step into a blackboard jungle, but they leave remarking, 'What a nice bunch of boys.' But that impression doesn't really square with the truth."
Well, it does square with the facts, and it doesn't, in that while they're on Penikese, they are a nice bunch of boys. And I think the point I was trying to make is that they're as good or as bad as the environment that they find themselves in. The one factor that our kids have learned, or the one skill our kids have learned from growing up in a absolutely random world, is the chameleon-like ability to adapt almost instantaneously to whatever the situation that they find themselves in.
Something else that you write, you say, "When I look objectively at the trail of destruction left by our graduates, I can't avoid the conclusion that the world would have been a better place if most of the kids I grew to like at Penikese had never been born." Would you explain?
Well, I suppose that if you look at anybody's life in terms of the amount of pain or the amount of happiness that they produce in their lifetime, you could then say that people that produce more pain than happiness are those that probably would have been better off not being born. I'm afraid that most of the pain our kids cause is inadvertent, but they cause it nonetheless to themselves and to others.
You started the school in 1973. You explained that the school has not been about miracles, that it's not a made-for-TV movie with a real happy ending. What were you expecting when you started the school? Were you expecting a more miraculous kind of change than you found in reality can be made?
Yeah, I think I made the same mistake that just about everybody makes in this business. I was looking for a cure, and I thought if we could come up with the right combination of buttons to push, that most of the kids that came to Penikese would leave Penikese productive members of society.
When you started the Penikese program in 1973, your idea was to structure it like the Marines. You had been a Marine. And you wanted it to be the kind of place where, as in the Marines, all your previous success and all your previous failures amounted to nothing. They just didn't count. What counted, what you did, was in the Marines. And that's how you wanted to be at Penikese. What you did before didn't matter. You had to prove yourself from scratch. Why were you going for a Marine type of program?
Well, I don't think I was going specifically for a Marine type of program. What I was trying to do was obviously based on what I had done before and what I knew and understood. What I was trying to do was to do as the Marine Corps does so successfully at Parris Island, and that is to just change all the rules, to pull kids out of a urban environment where they might be in the morning and put them on an island where they find themselves in the afternoon, where it's essentially a whole new start.
Now, Penikese is literally on an island, on a small island off Cape Cod. What's the routine, the daily routine at your island school?
Well, the routine revolves around what you have to do at that particular point in the year in order to support life on Penikees. We're the only people out there. There's no electricity. There's a primitive running water system that we put in. But essentially everything on the island was built by the staff and the kids working together. When we got to Penikees, the island had been uninhabited since 1939. There were the foundations of some buildings that dated back to the time when Penikees was a leper colony, but nothing was standing. So everything there we've built. We have a little farm. We raise chickens and pigs, and we build boats. We have to maintain the boat, which gets us back and forth to the mainland. So essentially it's doing the things that need to be done in that kind of remote community.
And you want the students to get a sense that if they're going to eat, they have to grow food. If they're going to be comfortable, they have to build a comfortable shelter, that there's a direct correlation between the actions they take and the comfort of their life.
Yeah, that, for lack of a better word, is our therapy. And it's based on the observation that the one common denominator to all the kids that come to Penikees is total confusion, in that they've grown up in a world so random that they've never been able to make even the most basic cause-effect connections between what they do and what happens to them. And as a result, they're all entirely fatalistic in terms of their future. They don't see that they have any control over their own destinies. And the purpose of living in a place like Penikees is to show them, by the means that you just described, that in fact they do, what they do and what they don't do affects not only themselves but also the people around them.
George Cadwallader is my guest, and he's the founder of the Penikees Island School, which is a school for delinquent youth. He's written a new book about it, which is titled Castaways. You have a lot of chickens on the island, I suppose, for the eggs that they lay and for food and so on. One of the members of the school, one of the youth there, one year broke all the legs of all the chickens. Was that a real shock to you that one of the kids at your school would do something like that?
It was when it happened, because the school was only a year old at that point, and that was our first direct exposure with the kind of sort of mindless brutality that we've seen an awful lot of since. I think what really bothered us all in that particular incident was that there was no purpose to it. Nothing was served.
I know that you believed that if you gave the kids your trust that they'd give theirs in return. And you were really burned a couple of times. One of the students stole your car for a night. Other students did things that really violated the trust that you gave them. So what did that mean to you? Did that mean you were going to stop giving them your trust at all?
No, it means that you have to become schizophrenic. I mean, what choice do we have if we're going to prepare kids for a world that where trust plays a part? Most law-abiding citizens abide by the law simply because they, not because of fear of penalties, but because they believe in it. And I think we have to do the same thing, realizing full well that it's probably not going to work. We have to hold kids accountable for their behavior when we realize that accountability is sort of a meaningless concept for them. We have to keep trying to get across to them that if they're trusted, that puts them under some responsibility. But we can't fool ourselves that it's going to work all the time, and as we would hope it would work. A rather incoherent answer to your question.
Well, accountability can be a really complex issue. And as an example, I'd really like for you to tell the story of the student from your school who went home and nearly raped your babysitter. Could you tell that story?
Yeah, it's a sad story in that he was a boy who'd pretty much grown up on the street. At the time we started the school, we started it with the arrangement with the Department of Youth Services that all our kids would go home every third weekend. It's now every second weekend. But in some cases, we were sent kids that had no home to go to. And this particular boy spent the weekend with us on such short notice that we had we were going out for dinner and it was too late to cancel that. So we took him to the movies with the understanding that we would go to dinner and then come back and pick him up at the end of the movies. Unfortunately, before we left, he got a look at our babysitter, and so after we dropped him off at the movies, he hitchhiked home and spent the evening talking to the girl. And I think it was it must have been a rather remarkable evening in many ways, because the girl and the boy came from such totally different backgrounds that they might as well be talking to a Martian. in that he had lived in a world absolutely brutal. She had lived in a world with decent parents and good schools, supporting community, all of the things that we hope our children will have as they grow up. The long and the short of the story is that the boy took her kindness the wrong way, made advances on the girl that she tried to reject, and at that point he lost his temper, and had we not just happened back from our dinner party at that time, it probably would have led to a rape. It's a story without much of a moral. The saddest part of the story is that the boy, having committed this crime, or nearly committed this crime, ran away, and then in despair came back, hoping that somehow he would be able to patch things up and see that girl again, because he'd never met somebody like that. And he was very much aware that he, as he had done with everything else in his life, he had spoiled that situation as he'd spoiled all the other ones.
We were talking about the importance of accountability in teaching young people that actions have consequences. After this near rape had occurred, you had to decide whether you were going to encourage or discourage your babysitter and her parents from pressing charges against this boy or not. And you actually discouraged them from pressing charges.
No, I didn't. I don't think that's quite correct that I discouraged them. I'm ashamed to say that my first thought was, how are we going to get this incident put to bed with as little publicity and as little attention as possible? I guess I realized that was the wrong way to go fairly quickly, and was about to call the police when the boy, in fact, turned himself back in. He came back to our house. The girl and the girl's mother asked that we not press charges, and in fact, we didn't do that. In terms of accountability, however, we could not keep that boy at the school, and the altercation I had with the Department of Youth Services that night and the following day was whether, in fact, they would take him back. I had to take him off in the boat for a couple of days until the department agreed to return him to their custody.
So there's no way you're going to bring him back to the school?
We couldn't. I think we have to put the good of the group and the good of the school ahead of the good of any one individual. The school was new in those days. There was a good deal of skepticism on the part of the Woods Hole community where we live, as to the wisdom of bringing these kinds of kids into town. And I think we had to show the community, and we had to show the rest of the kids, and we had to show everybody that there is some behavior that just cannot be condoned, and that if it occurs, the least we can do is get the boy out of town as quickly as possible.
Are those situations hard for you, where you realize you're going to have to give up on someone because they made a big mistake, and that for the benefit of the school, you're really going to have to let this person go?
Well, yeah, but what makes the decision easier to make is that we are trying to teach accountability. We are trying to teach kids that what they do has some effect on their futures. And you can't make that point if you constantly forgive people for really reprehensible behavior. I think that punishment has to play a part in rehabilitation, and if kids overstep the line consistently or far enough, then we owe it to them to demonstrate that the system has some teeth in it, that they're going to face a more coercive alternative than Penikese can offer.
George Cadwallader is my guest. He's the founder of the Penikese Island School for Delinquent Boys, and it's located in the Penikese Island, which is just off of Cape Cod. We're going to talk some more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, George Cadwallader, has written a new book about his Penikese Island School, and the book is called Castaways. The impression I've gotten is that you've really come to see the delinquent boys who come to your schools as kind of dividing into different categories, and you seem to really have a division between what you've now termed old-fashioned delinquents and a newer breed that you're finding? What are the differences between these two generations, or two different styles, I should say, of delinquency?
Well, the difference may exist more in our minds than in fact, but what we refer to nostalgically as the old-fashioned delinquent is the more typical view of delinquency. That is a boy who's grown up in a part of the world where he has no choice but delinquent behavior. But basically, he remains an intact individual. He's capable of friendship and loyalty, and he has his own code of honor, if you will. It may not be ours, but at least it exists, and it's one that he sticks to. The more damaged kid, which I'm afraid is the more common, is a kid that has no values, that for whom there is no such thing as friendship, no such thing as loyalty to his colleagues or to anybody else, and who essentially is simply reacting to whatever the strongest impulse of the moment is at any one time.
What's responsible for that change, do you think? I mean, why are you seeing so more of the kind of young people who seem to have no values, as opposed to what you call the more old-fashioned kind of delinquent who at least had a code to follow?
I think it all stems from what we were talking about earlier, the completely random environment that a kid grows up in. If a child grows up in a world where his parents are one way sober and another way drunk, where none of the messages he receives allows him to make, again, consistent cause-effect connections between what he does and what happens to him, it's impossible for him to develop any kind of standardized behavior, if you will, and a code of behavior is, in fact, that. We say that we will do some things, we won't do other things. But for a kid who has grown up in this nightmare world, this absolutely senseless world, there is no guide. So he might as well do whatever he feels like.
I'm going to ask you to tell another story about one of your students. And this was a boy who you really had high hopes for. He'd gotten a very good job, actually, working on one of the docks doing boat repair. But he really disappointed you. Could you tell us what happened?
Yeah, I think probably, and the reason I mention him in the book, is the classic example of this boy whose only guide to behavior is to satisfy the impulse of the moment. He could be, to a remarkable degree, as good or as bad as the situation he found himself in. As long as he was with us, he was a kid of great talent with his hands. He had the makings of being a superb boat builder. And as long as we could keep him in a decent environment, he was a decent kid. I use the example that he would have made as good an acolyte for an alder guild as he would have made a guard for a concentration camp. Because essentially he didn't exist. He was simply a sponge, if you will, that reacted to whatever the dominant influence that he found himself exposed to.
So what was the incident that happened to him after he'd gotten this job?
Well, he came to us on a rape conviction, and which he stoutly denied, and I believe actually was able to convince himself of his own innocence. While he was at the school, he and two others stole a car, killing a fourth occupant, the fourth occupant not being one of our students. That case went to trial in the adult course. It, as a result of delaying tactics on the part of the boy's lawyer, it was almost a year before it came to trial, a year during which he went from real remorse at the death of the fourth occupant of a friend of his, to really having forgotten the whole incident and actually being rather proud of himself for facing adult time and having serious charges, vehicular homicide. When he went to court, as a result of our intervention that I now regret, the judge was convinced to suspend his sentence. He was found guilty, but given a suspended sentence on terms that he returned to his apprenticeship with the boat builder for an additional year. That didn't work. As soon as he no longer had that court case hanging over his head, he went entirely to pieces. He was, I think, was an alcoholic before he came to the school, and that problem was perhaps in remission for a period of time, but it reasserted itself, and he drank himself to destruction after he'd returned to us for that second year.
This must have been a very, very frustrating and defeating situation for you. This is someone who you thought had really been doing pretty well. And they get into this car accident, kill someone through the accident in the car, and end up getting into more trouble afterwards. How do you handle situations like that? Does it make you want to give up on the kids and figure, well, they'll be fine at the school, but as soon as we let them go, they're just going to get into trouble anyways? What's the point? I mean, did it make you feel hopeless? How did you overcome the kind of hopelessness that it might have made you feel?
Well, it was discouraging. There's no question about that, because that boy was in a program that we had just devised, which was a follow-on for graduates of the island who, having spent 6 months or so at the island, then moved into Woods Hole, where they lived under our supervision and worked as apprentices to various trades and professions in the Falmouth area. That was my cure for delinquency, that particular combination of programs. We had them 6 months on the island where we taught them how to work, where we taught them that, where we hoped that we taught them such values as honesty and loyalty and cooperation and just respect for other people. And having done that, I then felt that if we could move them ashore and teach them how to live on their own, how to eat properly, how to get up on time, and at the same time provide them with an apprenticeship, that the combination of all of these things would give about the best possible opportunity that one could provide a kid in trouble. So I really felt that that between the island and what we call our job training program, we had the, quote, cure for delinquency. When our first three students, all of whom were doing extraordinarily well at their jobs, went and stole that car, you're right, that was a great disappointment. I think, though, that it caused all of us involved with the school to approach the job more realistically than perhaps we had in the past, and to realize that we're not, for most of our students, going to make fundamental changes in their lives and immediately visible changes in their lives. Essentially, what we're doing is we're making a bad situation somewhat less bad. And if we can take a kid who came to the island angry enough to be capable of murder, and when he leaves the island, he's stealing cars, that's significant progress. It's not progress that's going to show up in any kind of statistics. And I've become very suspicious of statistics in this business. I think you cannot measure in terms of numbers how effective we are in rehabilitation. We're not going to save everybody, but if we can make them slightly better than they were, then I think we've earned our keep.
Well, I'm glad you brought up statistics. You actually give some of your own in your book, and you say that you found that 16% of the boys who leave the school do pretty well afterwards, but the other 84% seem to get into trouble again. So on one level, you could say, well, that's an 84% failure rate. You've had to come to terms with those statistics. Obviously, you're not handing out some kind of miracle cure for the kids who come to your island school. Have you found a way to be satisfied with the 16% rate?
Yeah, those statistics specifically, where 16% went on to become successful citizens, and by success that meant that they were free of any form of public support and they were productively occupied either as a job or in school or in the service, and essentially valuable citizens. Then there were 34% who were in kind of a gray area where their lives were by no stretch of the imagination successful, but they were hurting themselves more than they were hurting society, at least directly. And then finally there were 50% who were in fact at the time and showed every likelihood of being career criminals. Those numbers may change somewhat if we're going to do another follow-up study, and we may find that we have a 20% success rate or a 12% success rate. Again, I don't think they mean a whole lot. I think Penicke's effectiveness may lie in that 34%. We may have taken potential members of the 50%, potential career criminals, and moved them up a notch so that they're in the 34% category, in the sort of marginal category, but not destructive.
Is it fair to say that you distrust and have little patience with the kinds of miracle success stories that we sometimes hear?
Yeah, I distrust them for a number of reasons, the main one being that they make it easier for society at large to overlook the real problems that cause delinquency. It's nice to be able to pick up a magazine and read about somebody who claims to be able to cure 95% of seriously delinquent teenagers. We can then say, well, that takes care of delinquency and move on to the next problem. They make it possible for us to overlook the fact that we have a large subculture of kids who are moving through our rehabilitation system virtually untouched by it. And if we're going to do anything about those kids. We're going to have to think about such issues as violence on television. We're going to have to work harder to make sure that young children get proper diets, and perhaps young mothers get proper diets. We're going to have to think about the whole theme that runs through our society, which says that violence, if used on the side of right, is good. Rambo is a good fellow. Rambo's enemies aren't. They both use the same. They're both equally violent. I think Rambo is a pretty senseless role model to present young people with.
Do you think your methods have changed since 1973 with all that you've learned in the interim?
Yeah, we have changed. We were under the delusion that that delinquents were sort of inadequate human beings that became delinquent because they couldn't do anything else. And so we felt if we could boost their confidence and show them that they could succeed in straight society, that in fact they would succeed in straight society. I think that's a rather simplified view of the problem. Confidence in terms of the ability to master physical obstacles is not lacking among these kids. I mean, most of them have been involved in high-speed car chases, and they've jumped off 60-foot walls and all kinds of stuff. What they lack, and the way I guess we have changed, is we've gone from sort of a outward-bound type program to more of an extended family, because that's the one thing they haven't had, is any kind of a family that works. And so essentially, we hire staff who can serve as sort of older brothers, older sisters, fathers and mothers to the kids. And we try and make Penikey's function in that way, so that it's a group of people. The distinction between staff and students is blurred when the place is working properly. It's a group of people collectively just doing what has to be done to support life out there.
What keeps you at the school? I'm sure it's not the high pay. Somehow I doubt you're getting paid a huge salary. It's a very frustrating job. I'm sure it's a job with a real high amount of stress and burnout. What keeps you going?
No, it's not a frustrating job. One impression I would like to disabuse people of is that we're all a bunch of saintly types who passed up high-paying jobs and all the rest of it to do this. Working at Penikey's is a lot of fun. If it wasn't, we wouldn't do it. It allows me and the other people that work there to lead the kind of life that we enjoy leading and perhaps do some good in the process, and I think that's kind of an optimum job description. The other thing you have to remember is that every kid on the island while he's there is potentially a member of that 16%. We don't know who is going to succeed and who's not going to succeed. So while they're there, they're all potential successes. And they all show us that they have that in them. It may not come out, but it's there.
Okay, George Cadwallader, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
George Cadwallader is the founder of the Penikey's Island School for Delinquent Youth, and his new book about the school is titled Castaways. It's just been published by Chelsea Green Publishing Company. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Drs. William Masters, Virginia Johnson, and Robert Kolodny about their research into the risk that the AIDS virus poses to the heterosexual population. Their research is contained in their new book, Crisis: Heterosexual Behavior in the Age of AIDS. I hope you can join us.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz singer and songwriter David Frischberg returns to the piano for part two of our interview, and he warns us not to believe everything he sings. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from composer and pianist Per Husby. In his native Norway, Husby's last album won the equivalent of the Grammy. Kevin says the new album should win some American listeners. And television critic David Bianculli says moonlighting has gotten tiresome. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. About 45 miles south of Jerusalem today, three Arab guerrillas hijacked a busload of Israeli civilians, killing one man before soldiers and police stormed the vehicle. Two other passengers were killed in the assault along with the hijackers. At least eight passengers were wounded. Israeli Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin says the Fatah faction of the Palestine Liberation Organization was responsible for the hijacking.
Another atrocity by Arafat PLO against the innocent civilians, two women, one man. They did not carry arms. Terror for the sake of terror is part of the policy of the PLO against any hope for peace, for negotiations in the region.
It's the single bloodiest incident in 3 months of anti-Israeli violence. Also today, the Israeli army said Arab rioters hurled a grenade for the first time in the unrest. There are reports that Israeli troops killed a Palestinian man during a protest at a refugee camp near Nablus, and the army reported 12 Arabs were wounded in scattered unrest. The federal government and Morton Thiokol have awarded $7.5 million to the families of four of the astronauts who died on the Space Shuttle Challenger. Rick McCourt reports on the newly released details of the settlement.
Morton Thiokol will pay 60% of the settlement amount and the federal government 40%. The $7.5 million will be distributed to the families of Commander Dick Scobie, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and schoolteacher Krista McAuliffe. Although the terms of the settlement were revealed today, the actual agreement was reached over a year ago through informal negotiations. The families of two other astronauts, Ronald McNair and Judy Resnick, reached a separate agreement with Morton Thiokol alone, the company that made the faulty booster rocket blamed for the Challenger explosion. That leaves just one case pending, a lawsuit brought by the family of Michael J. Smith against Morton Thiokol and former NASA official Lawrence Malloy. For National Public Radio, this is Rick McCourt in Washington.
A federal judge today granted Pat Robertson's request to drop a $35 million lawsuit against a former congressman who Robertson said lied about his Korean War record. The former TV evangelist asked to dismiss the suit because trial was scheduled to begin tomorrow, Super Tuesday. Robertson has agreed to pay nearly $500,000 in legal fees in order to have the suit withdrawn. Robertson trails in the opinion polls behind fellow Republicans George Bush and Robert Dole. Democrats Gary Hart, Albert Gore, Richard Gebhardt, and Jesse Jackson campaigned in Texas today. Michael Dukakis was trying to round up votes in Florida. Paul Simon, who has all but written off Super Tuesday, today predicted a brokered convention this summer for the Democrats. Simon said he doesn't think a frontrunner will emerge from the pack tomorrow. The Board of Trustees at Gallaudet University has refused to reconsider its decision to hire a non-deaf person to head the nation's only independent liberal arts college for the deaf. Marcos Martinez reports.
While the Board of Trustees met with student, faculty, and staff representatives, hundreds of students and their supporters continued to block the entrance to Gallaudet. The students had demanded the board hire a deaf person to be university president, that the makeup of the board itself be changed to include a majority of deaf people, and that board chair Jane Barrett Spillman resign. The board today rejected those demands. In remarks to students today, Spillman acknowledged that the board's choice for a new president does not have experience with deaf people. Students say they will continue to keep the university shut down until the nation's only college for the deaf has a deaf president. This is Marcos Martinez in Washington.
Television and movie scriptwriters are walking the picket line today. Talks between the Writers Guild and producers broke down last night over payment and creative control issues. Stock prices closed mixed in moderate trading on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell a point and a half to close at 2056.36. This is National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album from Norwegian composer Per Husby. Since the early 70s, this Oslo native has worked around Norway as a bandleader and freelance pianist. He's also worked as music host on Norwegian television. Husby's first big band album, Dedications, was released in 1985 and won the Norwegian equivalent of a Grammy Award. Now the sequel's out, and Kevin says it's time American jazz fans knew Husby.
As a rule, jazz musicians and composers don't listen much to the music of their colleagues, partly because they're too busy working on their own stuff and partly because they're wary of picking up influences. The Norwegian pianist Per Husby is an exception. As one of those so-called pickup musicians with whom traveling soloists work in Oslo, he needs to know the styles of the players he's expected to blend with. He's also put in some time as a fair and open-minded critic. Husby has recorded mostly with small groups. His second album for big band is Your Eyes, an hour-long compact disc on Norway's NOPA label. Husby wrote all the music and conducts a band of 12 Norwegian and English players, 3 rhythm, 4 reeds, and 5 brass, including French horn and tuba. While musicians don't like to be identified by their influences, in his notes, Husby pegs his: Charles Mingus, Ellington, Gil Evans, Bob Brookmeyer, and Hall Overton. He's not just putting on airs. His main departure point is Mingus's dense orchestral music of the 60s and 70s, where the whole band would rev up to play a single line, framing solos without smothering them. Husby's Blue Silk and the 12-minute Chan Sorta Mingus Blues make the connection explicit. On this long excerpt from the latter, the bass clarinetist is John Sermon and the altoist is Ray Warley.
Thank you.
That's a fragment from Chan's Sorta Mingus Blues. It's been a long time since European jazz musicians have been regarded as freaks, but Norwegian composers who write interesting blues are still slightly more scarce. There are a few awkward moments here where Husby strains for effect, but generally he protects himself by keeping his touch light, trusting his band to pick up the slack. Drummer John Christensen is the kind of obtuse rhythm player some critics can't abide, but I like the way he goes against the grain, keeping the band from getting complacent. Husby wrote this music for the particular players on the date, but they wound up futzing with his charts, which ensures that the music fits them as snugly as these arrangements fit into the jazz mainstream. Per Husby is one of those rare composers who writes insistently pretty music that doesn't get sentimental or mawkish. Every country can use a few.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Per Husby's new album, Your Eyes, on Norway's NOPA label. It's distributed here by North Country. This is Fresh Air. David Frischberg writes songs with clever lyrics on such improbable subjects as an attorney named Bernie and former baseball player Van Lingle Mungo. On our last show, Frischberg played some of his songs and talked about his transition from pianist to singer-songwriter. He's back at the piano for part two of our conversation, but before he performs, I'd like to play something from his new album, Can't Take You Nowhere, something that shows off his piano playing. What were some of the high points of your career as a pianist before you started writing songs?
Well, I guess the high point of my career was when I lived in New York in the 60s and kind of saw all my dreams come true and got to play with all the great jazz musicians I'd ever dreamed of playing with, notably Al Cohn and Zoot Sims and their band at the Half Note for years in New York, and got to play and make records with such as them and Jimmy Rushing. And then I got to play with a lot of my heroes like Ben Webster and Buck Clayton and Wild Bill Davison and Edmund Hall and the people at Condon's, and I got to play for singers that I admired so much, like Irene Krall.
You know, you're the pianist on one of my favorite records, which is a Jimmy Rushing album called The You and Me That Used to Be. And on it, I mean, he's a blues shouter who sang with Count Basie. This is an album mostly of standards. And on it, he sings a very unlikely song for Jimmy Rushing by Mia Bistichene.
Oh, yeah.
And it's such a great recording. I was wondering if hearing him sing that kind of changed the meaning of the song for you.
Well, he and I selected the repertoire for that song.
Did you select that with him?
For that album. And he picked by Mia Bistichene. He suggested it, and I was taken aback. I had no idea. He said, "I've always liked that tune. Let's do it."
Did you try to talk him out of it?
Not at all. He had never recorded it before, and he always said he always wanted to. I'm so glad, Terry, that you mentioned that album, because that to me is an unforgettable experience to make that album. And one of the things that made it so unforgettable for me was that recording took place on my last 2 days in New York, I was packing up my apartment and everything, all my belongings, and getting ready to move to Los Angeles. And after we finished recording that morning, I jumped on an airplane and was gone. So when I listen to that record, I hear myself playing, and I remember my state of mind at that time.
Well, I think we should listen to just a bit of that record. Now, I should mention that this album is about to be reissued on compact disc, but I don't think it's out yet, so I think what we'll have to do is listen to my old scratchy copy of it.
Of all the girls I've known, I have known some. Until I first met you, I was lonesome. And when you came in sight, dear, my heart grew light, and the world seemed new to me. You really swell, I have to admit you. Deserve expression that really fit you. And I've racked my brains hoping to explain the things you do to me. If I'm mere piss to shame, please let me explain. If I'm mere piss to shame, means that you're grand.
Now, you mentioned that that album was recorded on during your last couple of days of living in New York. Then you moved to Los Angeles for a while, and now you live in Portland, Oregon. You have a really nice song about missing New York called Do You Miss New York?
Yes, I wrote that on the occasion of returning to New York after I had been gone for about 3 or 4 years. And I came back to appear in New York and do my songs, you know. And so I wrote that for my friends back there to let them know that, yes, I still miss them.
Would you play a verse of that for us?
I'll play a little bit of it. Yeah,
that'd
let's
be great.
See. What's a good spot to come in on? Do you miss New York? The anger, the action. Does this laid-back lifestyle lack a certain satisfaction? Do you ever burn to pack up and return to the thick of it? Or are you really sick of it, as you always say? Do you miss the pace, the rat race, the racket? And if you had to face it now, do you still think you could hack it? And so on. It goes on and on from there.
It's a nice song.
Reaches a particularly maudlin climax.
Do you still miss New York?
No, I never did. I just wrote the song as just kind of a gesture. I never have missed New York. I never looked back once.
You know, I just can't believe anything that you sing anymore.
Well, you know, it's interesting you should say that, because it's a kind of a tempting proposition today that when you hear a singer. And this didn't used to be that way. When we used to hear Bing Crosby or Perry Como or Doris Day sing, we never would think that they were singing their actual own personal sentiments. But I guess it must have been since Bob Dylan or something that now when we hear somebody sing a song, we figure that's the way he really feels about things. You know, his heart is really breaking.
But that's a really nice point, that we do expect that all songs are autobiographical and confessional. And so you just write songs in personas of different characters.
Excellent. That's exactly what I think, Terry. The more I look at my songs, the more I understand that each one of them is a kind of a character piece.
I know that Frank Lesser is one of your favorite songwriters.
Yes, he is. Uh-huh.
What makes him that? What do you love about his songs?
Oh, I love the way he was a fearless melody writer, absolutely fearless. And a lot of people kind of overlook that in Frank Lesser and think of him as a clever lyric writer, of which he was, much more than a clever one. He was also a guy that could bring all kinds of vernacular to lyrics and make
exactly,
it sound so
yeah.
natural.
Mm-hmm.
You knew the character just by the choice of words that he would use in a lyric.
Would you play one of his songs for us?
Well, let's see. I always like this one. I see the cool, clear eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Yet there's that upturned chin and the grin of impetuous youth. I believe in you. I believe in you. And so on.
I really like that song, too. I'm glad you chose to do that one.
Well, I like it especially because I'll never forget how it was staged with Robert Morris, who I saw in the show, How to Succeed. He was shaving in the mirror when he sang the song. And when you know that, the song really comes to life in a different way, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure. Instead of being a compliment to someone else, it's total narcissism.
That's right.
Did you ever wish that you lived during the days of Tin Pan Alley when there were so many like great singer-songwriters?
Yes. I don't sit and brood about it, but I do sometimes think to myself that if I had been born 25 or 30 years earlier, my songs would be actually in the mainstream of the musical consciousness, and I'd be getting all that movie work, and I'd be writing those movie songs, and I'd be getting to write with people like Mercer and Hoagie Carmichael. And I think to myself, gee, that would have been a great time to live. I would have enjoyed that a lot. But then, of course, I never would have played with Al Cohn and Zoot Sims.
Yeah.
So it balances out, you know?
Dave Frischberg, it's really been fun to have you with us. Thanks so much. And can I ask you to play one final song for us, one of your own?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is a song I wrote for Mary Tyler Moore to close one of her shows. This is you. This is real. This is truly the way you feel. You can run and you can hide. Oh, but someday, someplace, we each of us winds up face to face with that little voice inside.
David Frischberg performing from the studios of NPR station KUOW in Seattle. His new album, Can't Take You Nowhere, is on the Fantasy label. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
Gearing up for Super Tuesday?
Yes, we are. We have several stories, and among them, our political correspondent, Linda Wertheimer, offers a capsule version of the candidate Jesse Jackson's stump speech. Also, we examine the beliefs of evangelical Christians and how those beliefs are expressed in electoral politics. Obviously, Pat Robertson's candidacy has spawned a great deal of curiosity and some fear in those who know little about evangelical Christianity. We report tonight on what motivates Pat Robertson's supporters. And also a report on the science of poll taking, sizing up how scientific are the polls.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The ABC television show Moonlighting won't be seen this week. It's preempted by the network's coverage of Super Tuesday. It won't be hard for the show's fans to adjust to another week without the storyline moving forward. Television critic David Bianculli says the glow of Moonlighting has been eclipsed for some time.
Historians love to sift through old records and artifacts and figure out why and when certain empires bit the dust. There's no reason why TV critics can't do the same thing. And I think I've located, in retrospect, the precise moment that Moonlighting stopped its rise and began its fall. No, it wasn't last fall, when Sybil Shepherd's Maddie and Bruce Willis's David played all their scenes in isolation from one another because of her pregnancy and his movie deal. It wasn't last month, when Maddie returned from her long trip with a brand new husband, a guy she'd met on the train. And it wasn't even last week, when her new husband basically ended the marriage after seeing how much she and David loved each other. All those moments were pretty stupid. But Moonlighting really started sliding earlier than that, about a year ago. That's when the romance between David and Maddie was reaching critical mass, but two things were keeping them from consummating their relationship. One was rerun interruptus, all those repeat episodes in between the new ones. The other was guest star Mark Harmon as Sam, the astronaut who proposed to Maddie. The choice she had then was to marry a perfect, safe guy like Sam, or commit to a rowdy guy like Dave. Sam visited Dave one night to discuss it privately.
What I'm trying to say is if you don't really care about her, you should tell her. And if you do care about her, well, she should know that too. It's just that it's real obvious who and what's best for her.
I thought so too, but Maddie chose David instead. Later that same episode, the two of them finally made love, but their idea of foreplay was, typically, an argument, complete with a few slaps to the face.
I may have just let the best thing that ever happened to me get away, and look at me, here I am, spending the evening having another pointless argument with you.
Fine.
Fine.
Good.
Good.
Bitch.
Bastard. Get out. Get out!
That wasn't romance, that was Tarzan and Jane. It was true to their characters, but maybe it was too true. When Maddie decided she liked David more, I liked her, and Moonlighting, a little less. Since then, the show's gone downhill faster than Alberto Tomba. David's gone from a feisty maverick to a whimpering puppy, while Maddie's gone from whiny to whinier. She ought to stay up an hour later and star on 30-something. And if she was going to marry a safe, nice guy like Walter, why didn't she just call up Sam and marry him? He was so perfect, he would have forgiven everything and said yes. So now what? Moonlighting has become such a drag that when Viola dresses in drag to sing The Lady is a Tramp at a stag party, he sings the whole song, just to kill time because the writers don't know what else to do. The Olympics lasted longer than Maddie's marriage, and there seems to be only one possible way the writers can revive this series and get everything back on the right track. They have to hire Patrick Duffy for an episode, and have Bobby Ewing come out of Maddie's shower to say, "None of that happened, the whole season was a dream." Moonlighting fans would understand the joke and welcome it. And Maddie and David could go back to flirting and feuding like they did in the good old days.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. A new episode of Moonlighting will air next Tuesday. We'll walk by night. We'll fly by day. Moonlighting strangers who just met on the way. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow I'll talk with character comedian Jeffrey Essman. His sketches lampoon everything from New Age spirituality to one-man shows. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the glitter rock band the New York Dolls. Their frontman was David Johansen, who's since recast himself as the martini-swilling crooner Buster Poindexter. And book critic John Leonard will review S, the new novel by John Updike. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty, Lisa Bruton, and Deborah Beagle. Research assistants from Gavin Morrison, Ruth Harold, and Carol Jewett. Our engineer is Richard Parker. Chris Bergen and Lisa Bruton directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.